Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed One, the Worthy One, the Supremely Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed One, the Worthy One, the Supremely Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed One, the Worthy One, the Supremely Enlightened One. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
One of the qualities of our teacher, the Buddha, is that he's said to be the greatest teacher of gods and humans, the supreme trainer of people who can be trained. We know that for his long 45-year teaching career, he taught people from all walks of life. He taught beggars and farmers and servants, all the way up to kings, people in palaces, nobility, soldiers. He taught not only human beings, but heavenly beings as well. Sometimes deities would come and seek him out. Sometimes he would travel to the heavenly realms to teach to them. So when we read the suttas, we have the opportunity to see how the Buddha taught in different circumstances, how he taught to different people. And there are some individuals that we actually see a lot in the suttas, and even get to witness their progression in developing faith in the Buddha. So one of those people is a king named King Pasenadi. So at the time of the Buddha, there were many small kingdoms throughout the Ganges River basin, the watershed, I guess we'd say today. Several different kingdoms, several different forms of government in a variety of different kingdoms. And the Buddha traveled throughout this area, teaching to both the royalty as well as the common folks. And one of those kingdoms where he spent a lot of time is the kingdom of the Kosalas. It's towards the north, right next to his home area of Kapilavatam. And the king in this area was named Pasenadi. Pasenadi is his first name. Kosala is his clan name. And he lived in the city of Savati. So when we read the suttas, we see many, many suttas that are given in Savati because the Buddha spent a lot of time in that area. So we know that some of the royalty that the Buddha taught, their minds were ready to grasp the Dhamma very deeply, very quickly, and so many of them attained stream entry right on the spot. So, for example, King Bimbisara in Rajagaha, he had actually met the Buddha before the Buddha attained enlightenment, And interestingly, King Bimbisara was so impressed by the sort of the carriage and the demeanor of the Buddha that he said, "Oh, you shouldn't be a monk. You need to be, you know, you need to share this kingdom with me. Come and be a king and help me rule this kingdom." But the Buddha said, no, I have a different goal in life. And King Bimbisara said, "Okay, that's fine, but whenever you achieve that goal, you come back and you teach me the Dhamma." And so the Buddha went to him after he attained enlightenment, taught the Dhamma to King Bimbisara, and right on the spot, King Bimbisara attained the first stage of enlightenment, stream entry. With King Pasenadi, it didn't go so quickly. It didn't go so smoothly. And in fact, we can learn about situations where King Kosala didn't have any faith in the Buddha at all. So, very fortunately for King Kosala, he had a queen, a wife, named Mallika. And Mallika had very strong confidence in the Buddha, and she was often on hand to counsel King Bimbisara. In fact, when it comes to wisdom, when we look at the two of them, clearly Queen Mallika comes out ahead. She at least crosses the line first, because she's often there to encourage her husband in the Dhamma and encourage him in faith. So one early event that happened was, and we can read this in detail in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Middle-Length Discourses. There was a rumor going around, and if folks could shut off your cell phones, because I haven't done that already, that's good. So there was a rumor going around that the Buddha had said that sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise because of those who are dear to us. And in fact, the Buddha had said this. Someone who was grieving the loss of a son had gone to the Buddha, and he was just, you know, destroyed. He had been crying so much. And the Buddha asked him why, and the man said, "Oh, I've lost my dear and beloved only son." And the Buddha said, "Yes, this is how it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, they all arise because of those who are dear." But this man, unfortunately, wasn't able to understand this, wasn't able to hear it, and so he went around criticizing the Buddha, saying how ridiculous this was. And the rumor spread so much that it made its way all the way to the palace. And King Pasenadi heard about it, and he asked his wife, Queen Mallika. He said, "Is this true, what your teacher, the Buddha, says?" And she says, "If the Buddha says it's true, then it's true." So much was her faith that she said, "Well, you know, I don't know what that means, but if the Buddha actually said that, then I'm sure it's true." King Pasenadi didn't have faith in the Buddha, and so he actually criticized his wife, saying, "Ah, whatever the Buddha says, you just go along with, right?" Just like these days we would say teacher's pet sits in the front of the classroom saying, "Ah, yes, teacher, ah, yes, teacher." And he even kicked her out of the throne room. So, because she was confident, her confidence hadn't been shaken, and because she wanted to help her husband overcome this doubt, this willingness to criticize the Buddha, she sent someone to go investigate, to find out. She sent one of the ministers in the palace saying, "Okay, go to the Buddha, ask if he really said this, and if he really said it, ask what it means." And so this man, obediently went to the Buddha and asked, what is it? You know, what does this mean? How can we understand this? And the Buddha explained. That we can see examples right here in this very city of people whose mother died, and when their mother died, they lost their minds. They went crazy, going street to street asking if anyone had seen their mother. Someone whose father died, brother died, sister died. Many, many people just in that very city had lost their minds with grief because they had to be separated from their loved ones. And so this member of the palace court came back to Queen Malika and explained the whole situation, explained the whole teaching. And so then she went back to her husband and said, okay, King, let me ask you some questions. If your daughter, the princess, was to die, would you be upset? And the king says, of course, she's so important to me. If something were to happen to her, it would be like something happening to me. My life would be destroyed if something happened to her. And Queen Malika said, that's what the Buddha meant. Right? See, she's dear to you, and because she's so dear to you, when something happens to her, then you have to cry. You have to suffer. And so Malika went through each member of the royal household, even getting to herself, saying, well, if something were to happen to me, you know, aren't I dear to you? Don't you love me? And he said, yes. If something were to happen to you, I would be devastated. And she said, yes. This is what the Buddha, the fully enlightened Buddha, has meant when he said that. And so when the king had this Kalyanamitta, so he was very fortunate, because not only did he have the Buddha as a Kalyanamitta, a spiritual friend, but he had someone right in his life who was willing to take the risk to teach him the Dhamma. And because of that, he was able to develop confidence in the Buddha. In fact, right there on the spot, he went for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So throughout his life, his confidence grows until at the very end of his life, when he turns 80, he has a visit with the Buddha where he expresses his devotion and love for the Buddha by going up and kissing the Buddha's feet. Right? So for a king, right, someone so high, to go so far as to kiss the feet of someone who, in the status level of society, was even outside the status system. For him to go to the Buddha and stroke his feet and cover them with kisses, we can see just how much his heart had gained confidence in the Buddha. So, for a little bit, I thought we could listen to some of the shorter conversations that happened between King Pasenadi, Kosala, and the Buddha. So we can find these conversations in a collection called the Samyutta Nikaya. This is the third collection of suttas in the Sutta Pitaka. And as you can see, the collection is quite large. There's thousands of suttas in here, but most of them are very, very short. Many of them even less than a page long. So, and they're organized by topic or by person that they're given to. So in this situation, all of these discourses in this chapter are all given to King Pasenadi Kosala, or about King Pasenadi Kosala. So, in the first one that we'll listen to today, it's called Aging and Death. And it begins, at Savati, Sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, for one who has taken birth, is there anything other to expect than aging and death?" So, someone who's born, can we expect to not die? Or is this what has to happen to everyone? And the Buddha says, King, for one who has taken birth, great king, there is nothing other to expect than aging and death. Even in the case of those affluent nobles, rich with great wealth and property, with abundant gold and silver, abundant treasures and commodities, abundant wealth and grain, because they have taken birth, there is nothing other to expect than aging and death. Even in the case of those affluent Brahmins, those affluent householders, rich with abundant wealth and grain, because they have taken birth, there is nothing other to expect than aging and death. So he says, all these people in society, no matter how wealthy they are, they're subject to aging. They're subject to death. If they live for a very long time, they'll get old. And whether they live long or live a short life, it ends in death. That because someone is born, we have to die. And this is why the Buddha said we need to work to escape from this cycle of birth and death. Right? Because no matter how exalted the birth is, even birth in the heavenly realms, still it has to come to an end. Then the Buddha says, even in the case of those monks who are arahants, whose taints are destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached their own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, and are completely liberated through final knowledge, even for them, this body is subject to breaking up, subject to be laying down. So he says, even those individuals who've attained enlightenment, who've followed my teachings all the way to the very end, who've given up craving and attachment, who've uprooted hatred from their minds, even they have to die. Even the Buddha himself got old. Right? He was so decrepit at the end of his life. The Buddha said it was just like this old, old cart that's held together by bits of rope and string, that is just kind of hobbling along. Right? So if this death, if this old age comes even to a Buddha, then what can we say about ourselves? And then the Buddha ends with a short verse. So this whole chapter is in the first section of this Samyutta Nikaya, where each of the discourses includes a short verse. So this is the verse included with this discourse. The Buddha says, "The beautiful chariots of kings wear out. This body too undergoes decay. But the Dhamma of the good does not decay. So the good proclaim along with the good." So here he gives us a nice little reminder that the Dhamma doesn't break down. Our bodies break down, our houses break down, our cars break down. But the truths that the Buddha taught, they don't decay. They don't wear out. They don't become not true. It's not that they were true in the time of the Buddha, and nowadays in modern life they don't apply to us. Not at all. There's no way we can think that. Right? Because isn't it true? We get old. We get sick. We pass away. Everyone that we love eventually has to leave us. So when we learn these teachings, it's important that we understand how to use them, right? Because Just because we know this doesn't mean we're able to use it properly. So someone who's very sad, who's very depressed, may constantly have the thought, I'm getting old, I'm getting old. I have to die, I have to die. Right? I'm going to die. Right? Someone can make themselves very sad and upset thinking about those things. So this is why we have to understand the reason that the Buddha taught us these things. That when we live our lives knowing that this human life is very short and that we have to be separated from everything that we hold dear, then we're sure to live this short life in a wholesome way, in a way where we collect good karma into our lives, in a way that we don't harm those around us, in a way where we develop wisdom, right? In a way that we take these teachings into our lives and practice them, right? Because some people may get the news, I'm going to die, I'm going to get old. And they take that news and they say, I better party it up now while I'm still young and can enjoy myself. While I still have this wealth, I should go out and party with my friends. Right? That's another conclusion that someone can draw from this, from these facts. But that's not the conclusion that the Buddha encouraged us to draw. Right? He encouraged us to think of the big picture and to realize the opportunity that we have to lead a good life, one that develops a happiness that's not transient, that's not based on external things. So another sutta called self-protected. And this in this sutta, the King Pasenadi goes to the Buddha and tells him what he's been thinking about. So this is a really great example of a disciple of the Buddha who hears the teachings and then goes away and keeps thinking about them. So the Buddha said that there's different kinds of listeners, that some listeners are like an upside-down pot, that no matter how much you try and put water into it, nothing sticks, right? It all just falls right out. He said, some people, they make the effort to go and visit monks and nuns and listen to the Dhamma, but even as they're sitting there listening, nothing is going in. Or you could say, in one ear and out the other. That they don't even pay attention to it when it's being taught. Other people, the Buddha said, they listen while they're there, but as soon as they stand up, they leave it all behind. He said, someone like that, it's like a person who's eating a meal, and as they're eating, bits of food and nuts and things have fallen onto their lap, and when they stand up to go, all those things just fall off their lap and stay there in the room. The Buddha said, some people are like that when it comes to listening. They listen to the sermon, but as soon as they stand up and leave, they never think about it again. But the best kind of listener, the Buddha says, is like a pot that's right side up. That whatever you put into it, it stays there. And you can carry that pot around wherever you want, holding the water or the food or whatever. He said, the best type of person, they listen to the Dhamma, they take it with them, and they keep it with them. They reflect on it. So that's exactly what King Pasenadi is doing when he hears these teachings. He goes back to the palace, and he thinks about what he's learned. So here he's reporting to the Buddha one of these contemplations that he had. He says, "Hear, Venerable Sir, when I was alone in seclusion, a reflection arose in my mind. Who now protects themselves, and who leaves themselves unprotected? Then Venerable Sir, it occurred to me, those who engage in misconduct of body, speech, and mind leave themselves unprotected. Even though a company of elephant troops may protect them, or a company of cavalry, or a company of chariot troops, or a company of infantry, still they leave themselves unprotected. For what reason? Because that protection is external, not internal. Therefore, they leave themselves unprotected. So, here the king is someone who has to be protected, right? Because somebody else always wants to be the king, whether it's a daughter or a son, whether it's the neighboring kingdom, somebody always wants to be in your place. So he understands very well this idea of protection. But he's heard the Dhamma. He's listened to the Buddha talk about karma and its results. And so he started to think in a different way about protection. Because he knows that when he commits unwholesome acts, when he kills, when he lies, when he steals, when he uses harsh speech, divisive speech, he knows that when he gets angry, when he cultivates thoughts of doubt, he knows that those karmas stick with him. But that this body, right, we take care of it and we protect it as best we can. But this body, we don't take it with us. When this body dies, it just rots back into the ground. And even if we have the best physical protection in the world, still, our mind is disturbed by the unwholesome actions that we've done. Then King Pasenadi says, even though no company of elephant troops protects them, nor a company of cavalry, nor a company of chariots, nor a company of infantry, still they protect themselves. For what reason? Because that protection is internal, not external. Therefore, they protect themselves. So, even if we have no protection, no physical protection around us, if we give up doing unwholesome actions, then we're really protected in this world. When we sit down to meditate, our mind isn't agitated. We're not overcome with thoughts of regret. So the Buddha agrees with King Pasenadi and says, indeed, that's absolutely right. And then finishes by reciting a verse. The Buddha recites this verse. He says, good is restraint with the body. Restraint by speech is also good. Good is restraint with the mind. Restraint everywhere is good. Conscientious, everywhere restrained, one is said to be protected. So, in our lives, we tend to think mostly about the external protection. And we do need to, you know, we need to look after our families. We need to make an effort to guard the possessions that we have. But that's only of ordinary value. It doesn't have anything to do with the cycle of rebirth. It doesn't have anything to do with escaping from the cycle of rebirth. It doesn't have anything to do with developing wisdom. So, the Buddha says, we start this training with a right view that allows us to have good ethical behavior. That when we have good ethical behavior, it acts as the foundation for all the other wholesome qualities that we're trying to develop in our minds. So another conversation that the king has with the Buddha, where he reports a reflection that he had. He says to the Blessed One, "Hear, Venerable Sir, when I was alone in seclusion, a reflection arose in my mind thus. Few are those people in the world who, when they obtain superior possessions, do not become intoxicated and negligent, yield to greed for sensual pleasures, and mistreat other beings." So, as the king, he would have this opportunity to see all kinds of things going on in the world. He, on a daily basis, he would see people suffering as they came to him, complaining about their neighbor or complaining about some government official who had harmed them. They oftentimes would have to sit in judgment of criminals and dole out punishments. From their palace window, they could see the people, even the low people in society, struggling to get by. And so the king has the opportunity to see people who become very wealthy, who achieve great material success. And he says to the Buddha, "You know, I don't see many people who don't become obsessed with their wealth when they get it. For the most part, when people become very wealthy, it becomes their entire lives, trying to protect that wealth, trying to get more and more." And this is one of the big problems that the Buddha teaches us about sensual pleasures, that no matter how many we get, we still want a little bit more. And the nicer things we get, the higher our standards become. We get introduced to people who are even wealthier than we are and find out about cars that are faster than ours, right? Houses that are bigger than ours, more beautiful than ours, food that's more delicious than the food that we've eaten. And for the most part, people don't say, "Oh, you know, one Maserati is enough," right? Because their friend has a Porsche, and they think, "Well, the Maserati is good for on the weekdays, but on the weekends I should have a Porsche, right? Shouldn't I?" Right? We see, nowadays you can go around and see five car garages. It's really unbelievable, right? We don't criticize people. It's their good karma that's allowed them to have such wealth. But do we know, is it really giving them happiness? Or is it giving them suffering? Is their mind peaceful because of that? Or is it more agitated? The king says, it's very rare to see people who don't get caught up in these things. He says, far more numerous are those people in the world who, when they obtain superior possessions, become intoxicated and negligent, yield to greed for sensual pleasures, and mistreat other beings. So, we can see that, can't we? That it's rare to find people who, when they become very wealthy, that they commit themselves to practicing generosity. That they think, surely, this great wealth that I've come into, it has to be a result. Not just of the actions that I've taken in this life, but previous karma as well. And if they're wise, they think, well, I'm using up that karma, right? Because it's not endless. Even though the results may come back to us 1,000 times more than than just the action that we did, the generosity that we practiced, still at some point, it comes to an end. So very few people think when they become wealthy, I need to make sure that in the future, I'm also living a comfortable life, that I have physical security so I can continue to practice the Buddha's teachings in a peaceful way. Right? Very few people, when they fall into great wealth, do they dedicate themselves to giving it away. Right? So rare is it that it becomes a news item. Right? Someone wins the lottery and they give all their money away to a certain charity or to people who are very poor. Right? Someone wins the lottery and they give away all their money, that's a news item. Right? That's the unusual thing in society. So it becomes front page news. The Buddha says, it's true. That's exactly true. And then recites these verses. He says, enamored with their pleasures and wealth, greedy, dazed by sensual pleasures, they do not realize that they've gone too far. Like the deer that enter the trap laid out, afterwards, the bitter fruit is theirs, for bad indeed is the result. So people don't realize, right, that the happiness that comes from material things, that it's hollow. Right? Nobody wants to have at their funeral people standing up and saying, oh yes, they were wealthy. They had more money than anybody else. Right? What's the honor in that? What's the good quality in that? So as we look at our lives, right, and see the material comforts that we have, we make use of them, we enjoy them, but we also always have to be very careful, thinking, yeah, I need to watch out. Because even as lay people, we can get caught up in these things. We can lose out on the opportunity to practice generosity, to practice humility. Right? Because so many people, they become wealthy and they become arrogant, thinking, I've worked really hard in this life. I deserve all the things that I have. These poor people, they're lazy. Right? We see that as a philosophy of life. Right? The wealthy people deserve to be wealthy. The poor people deserve to be poor. And if we listen to the Buddha's Dhamma and learn about karma and start to think that same way ourselves, we've totally misunderstood the Buddha's teachings. Right? Because we know, even if we're very wealthy in this life, next life, all bets are off. We know that the great wealth that we come into in this life, that surely the seeds of that wealth were planted long, long ago. And that when it comes to what really matters in this human life, wealth is the most insignificant, right? That generating good qualities in our hearts and minds, developing a mind that's generous, developing a mind that's kind, that's compassionate to others, that doesn't get angry, right? This is the real kind of wealth, the wealth that creates good karma that we take with us into the future. So another conversation. This one also happens at Savatthi, of course. And it begins, now on that occasion, five kings, headed by King Pasenadi Kosala, were enjoying themselves, supplied and endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure when this conversation arose among them. What is the chief of sensual pleasures? So what is the chief of sensual pleasures? Some among them said, forms are the chief of sensual pleasures. Some said, sounds are the chief. Some odors are the chief. Some tastes are the chief. And some tactile objects are the chief. So these very wealthy people sitting around saying, you know, I think that beautiful things to look at, those, they're the top sensual pleasure. Someone else said, no, the beautiful sounds, right, are very pure and wholesome, but yet can be so intoxicating. Someone else says, no, it's the smell. Smell is a very powerful, right, type of pleasure. Someone else says, no, it's taste. Someone else says, no, it's things that we touch. This is what kings would sit around and debate with each other. Not quite so wholesome, but that was their lives. So, since they weren't able to convince each other, King Pasenadi said, well, let's go talk to the Buddha. He knows about sensual pleasures. He says, come, dear sirs, let us approach the Blessed One and question him about this matter. As the Blessed One answers us, so we should remember it. They say, all right, dear sir. And those five kings, headed by King Pasenadi Kosala, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side. King Pasenadi reported their entire conversation to the Blessed One, asking, what now, venerable sir, is the chief of sensual pleasures? So what do you think? We can take a vote. Things to look at are really nice. Food is really nice. So, here's what the Buddha says. Great King, I say that what is chief among the five chords of the sensual pleasures is determined by whatever is most agreeable. Those same forms that are agreeable to one person, Great King, are disagreeable to another. When one is pleased and completely satisfied with certain forms, then one does not yearn for any other form higher or more sublime than those forms. For him, those forms are then supreme. For him, those forms are unsurpassed. So the Buddha says, different people like different things. For one person, there may be some form that's completely intoxicating. But that same thing, someone else looks at it and says, not so great. Because we all have these different types of desires, don't we? That some people like beautiful music, some people like delicious food, and along the way we can think, oh, you know, I've overcome my central desire when it comes to food. But beautiful music, gotta have that, right? But really, it's whatever just happens to appeal to us. And the Buddha goes through all the others, saying, those same sounds, those same odors, those same tastes, those same tactile objects that are agreeable to one person, Great King, are disagreeable to another. When one is pleased and completely satisfied with certain tactile objects, then one does not yearn for any other tactile object higher or more sublime than those tactile objects. For him, those things to touch are then supreme. For him, those things to touch are unsurpassed. So, that's the thing about sensual pleasures, that there's such a variety that it's easy for us to get caught kind of no matter what direction we go, that there's always something, right, beautiful to get attached to. And When the Buddha said that, there was one of these kings who said, I have this inspiration, Venerable Sir. And this was something that that people would do from time to time, especially if they grew up in a palace and had a royal education, they would like to compose verses on the spot. And so this king makes up this verse in praise of the Buddha right on the spot. He says, as the fragrant red lotus, Ko Kanada, blooms in the morning, its fragrance unspent, behold Angirasa, the radiant one, like the sun beaming in the sky. So these are words for the Buddha. Angirasa, the radiant one, he says, you know, the Buddha, he's beautiful. He shares this teaching with us. And so when the other five kings heard this, they were so happy, they wanted to honor this fellow, and they gave him five robes, five nice pieces of cloth. And this king accepted the cloth and gave all five to the Buddha right there on the spot. So there's about 20, 30 different, about 25 different discourses in this section. We obviously can't do all of them today, but we'll do one last one. So this also happens at Salvati. Now on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had eaten a bucket measure of rice and curries. Then, while still full, huffing and puffing, the king approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. So we don't know exactly what the measurement is for this bucket, but clearly he ate a lot of food, speaking of sensual pleasures. And so then, the Blessed One, having understood that King Pasenadi was full and was huffing and puffing, on that occasion recited this verse. He says, when a man is always mindful, knowing moderation in the food he eats, his ailments then diminish. He ages slowly, guarding his life. So when we read about the training for monks and nuns, the gradual training, it always includes being moderate in eating. But here clearly the Buddha thinks that this same advice would also be beneficial for King Pasenadi. When a man is always mindful, knowing moderation in the food he eats, his ailments then diminish. He ages slowly, guarding his life. So the Buddha understood that for things like sexual activity, they're not essential for the individual. And so for his monks and nuns, he said, okay, scratch that one out. You'll be much better off if you don't get involved with that. But for food, he tried doing without food and it didn't work. So that's why he's frequently encouraging his monks and nuns. Be moderate with your food. Only eat your food for the purpose of keeping the body healthy. And so here he gives a similar reminder to King Pasenadi. So because King Pasenadi had so much confidence in the Buddha, he heard this verse and he didn't get angry. He didn't think, the Buddha's criticizing me. He thought, this is my teaching. So on that occasion, the Brahmin youth, Sudassana, was standing behind King Pasenadi of Kosala. The king then addressed him thus, come now, dear Sudassana, learn this verse from the Blessed One and recite it to me whenever I'm taking my meal. I will then present you daily with 100 kahapanas as a perpetual grant. So that's a unit of money. He says, memorize this verse, and any time I'm eating, stand behind me reciting this verse. So the Brahmin youth says, "Yes, sir." And having learned these verses from the Blessed One, whenever King Pasenadi was taking his meal, the Brahmin youth, Sudassana, recited, "When a man is always mindful, knowing moderation in the food he eats, his ailments then diminish. He ages slowly, guarding his life." It would be nice, wouldn't it, if we all had servants that we could assign and stand behind us and say, "Okay, now when I'm about to do this, you recite this little bit of Dhamma. When I'm about to do that, you recite another verse." Right? That's a privilege that kings have. When we have the privilege of Kalyanamitta around us, we can get these reminders. Otherwise, it has to be up to us to remember the Dhamma and to bring it to mind when we need it. So, then King Pasenadi of Kosala gradually reduced his intake of food to at most a pint pot measure of boiled rice. At a later time, when his body had become quite slim, King Pasenadi of Kosala stroked his limbs with his hand and on that occasion uttered this inspired utterance: "The Blessed One showed compassion towards me in regard to both kinds of good, the good pertaining to the present life and that pertaining to the future life." So he realizes, the Buddha, he's looking out for me. He teaches me the Dhamma that's good for my happiness here and now, that can lead to my own physical well-being, and also teaches me the Dhamma that helps in future lives, that leads to putting an end to the cycle of rebirth. So there's many, many more suttas in this section, these conversations that King Pasenadi has with the king. We can also read other discourses, and especially the middle-length discourses, times when the king goes to ask more detailed questions, and as well this time at the very end of his life when he goes to the Buddha and praises all of the good qualities of the Buddha. So having had the opportunity to listen to these conversations between a fully enlightened Buddha and a very dear disciple, may we be like this King Pasenadi Kosala and reflect on the teachings that we've heard. May we be like the King Pasenadi Kosala and put these teachings into practice in our lives, thereby experiencing benefit in this life, in future lives, and one day experiencing for ourselves the supreme bliss of Nibbana in this Gautama Buddha's dispensation. Sarva. Sarva.